Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome to Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Austin Cross in for Larry Mantle. Happy Thursday morning to you. I just want to take a minute to thank you all for being part of our remembrance of the great Vin Scully yesterday. Vin's impact on the lives of not just Dodger fans, but Southern Californians from all walks of life was evident from your heartfelt memories and stories of what Vin meant to you. And we're so glad we were able to provide a platform for you to share with us. Coming up later this hour, we will continue our conversation about LA's new 6th Street Viaduct. That's a bridge that's been getting a lot of attention, for better or for worse. But the way we talk about the bridge is impactful. We'll talk about why. We'll also take a few minutes to spotlight one of our local heroes. And can I just say, I love this series. It's where we highlight some of the incredible work being done by Southern Californians. Not all heroes wear capes, but I'll tell you, one of them sits outside of a donut shop on the west side. We're going to hear more about him coming up, so stick around for that. Pull up a chair. But we start with professional basketball player Brittany Griner, who's been detained in Russia for months. A judge this morning sentenced Griner to 9 years in prison for drug possession and smuggling. And Griner has said bringing cannabis cartridges to the region was an honest mistake. U.S. officials and the Biden administration are negotiating for Griner's release, so it's not clear how much of that sentence Griner will actually serve. It's reported that the Biden administration has offered to exchange Victor Boot, a convicted Russian arms trafficker serving a 25-year sentence in U.S. prison, as a deal to release not only Griner, but a former U.S. Marine named Paul Whelan, who was arrested about 4 years ago in Moscow on espionage charges. Griner and Whelan are far from the only Americans detained abroad, so joining me to discuss the diplomacy and the political tactics behind negotiating prisoner releases is Dartmouth College Foreign Policy and International Relations Fellow Danielle Gilbert. Her current research explores the causes and consequences of hostage taking in the international security community, including hostage diplomacy. Professor Gilbert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, just to start off, is this the sentence that you expected? I know that a lot of us, we were watching it and we were thinking this probably isn't just about the cartridges. Is this how you expected this scenario to play out?
I was, unfortunately. But even if I was expecting the trial to go this way, it doesn't make it any less gutting. So more than 99% of criminal proceedings in Russia end in a guilty verdict. And the Russians have charged Brittany Griner with international drug smuggling, clearly not what she was actually doing. But the fact that they exaggerated and trumped up these charges doesn't make it any easier to bear.
So since this is your specialty, I have to ask about the role that she's playing in this greater conflict. Obviously, the tensions are considerably higher since Russia invaded Ukraine. But looking at it in general, taking a few steps back, what does a prisoner represent in this sort of scenario?
It's a great question. So an individual prisoner in one of these cases just represents leverage for our adversaries all around the world. Brittany Griner has made this phenomenon well known. She's brought it to the attention of the American public, but this is something that's been going on for years. The U.S. has adversaries all around the world, including Iran, Venezuela, China, and now Russia, other countries, including North Korea, Burma, Syria, Turkey, have arrested Americans and other foreigners and use their criminal justice systems to hold Americans hostage. And because it's really compelling to pay attention to this horrifying plight of an individual American citizen, it adds leverage for our adversaries, for them to be able to get things that they want from the U.S. government in ongoing geopolitical conflicts.
So I'm wondering about, you know, some of the calculations that these countries would make, because obviously this has been a very public trial for Brittany Griner. There's mm-hmm. been audio clips. There's been video footage of her being brought in chains, chained to a guard. The imagery, it's, you know, pretty much made for social media. The sense that mm-hmm. I get is that Russia wants us to see this. And they want, you know, people to maybe encourage the Biden administration to try to make a deal to bring an American home who, you know, mm-hmm. we all get the sense that, you know, this wasn't truly justice. What could they truly want to get out of this? Is it about Victor Boot, or is it about, for them even, just for the sake of their media and showing their people, you know, this Brittany Griner represents America as a whole and this Westernism that we're currently fighting against a little bit?
An important thing for us to remember in these crises is that no matter what happens, whether or not the U.S. government makes any concessions, the Russian government wins. They've embarrassed the United States. They have raised the kind of difficult diplomatic, domestic political debates in the United States. And so even if the United States government decides to make concessions to bring Brittany Griner and Paul Whelan home, it's been a really difficult moment for the White House. And so no matter what happens, the Russians take a win out of this situation, which is something that we really need to keep in mind. The media element of this is quite difficult, because if you are a member of Brittany Griner's family or her community, you want to raise as much attention to this as possible to put pressure and keep pressure on the White House to make whatever deal they have to make to bring her home. But that attention also plays into the hands of the Russians. The more pressure that the White House feels, the more it might need to make the kinds of concessions that are really tough pills for a government to swallow.
I'm talking right now with Danielle Gilbert. Her current research explores the causes and consequences of hostage taking and international security, including hostage diplomacy. Danielle, I'm wondering, obviously there's a long history of other countries taking Americans essentially hostage, maybe trumping up some mm-hmm. charges and keeping them for a number of years in hopes of maybe getting something out of it. Have you noticed over the past cases that we might consider, if there's more public pressure on a presidential administration here to bring home, say, a person who was imprisoned while doing their military duties versus an American civilian who accidentally brought vape cartridges or, you know, accidentally, I'm thinking of Otto Warmbier, the case of Otto Warmbier in the North Korea incident where he allegedly took a propaganda poster from a hotel.
So I once heard a former hostage make a comment that on the day that he was kidnapped, that he made an honest mistake, and that anyone who is taken hostage in this kind of situation made a small mistake that then they are forced to pay for with these devastating outcomes that completely alter their lives. The way that Americans end up in these captive situations can really affect how the public and whether the public rallies behind their case. So in my research, I essentially show that the circumstances under which someone was captured and whether the American public blames the person for putting themselves in a situation of danger will dramatically affect whether or not the public supports government efforts to bring them home. Mm. There's a few other factors that might affect that as well, and that involves the person's gender and race, their sexuality. A lot of the Americans who are taken in these wrongful detentions and hostage situations are dual nationals. And so it's easy for them to travel to a place like Venezuela or Iran, where most Americans might never consider traveling. And when those people go home just to visit their family or to do some business, they're arrested under these egregious situations. And so the American public really does have very strong opinions about what kinds of victims they consider worthy of government support.
And I do recall, based off of research that came out of the 2016 election about Russian tampering, that within the Russian government, there is a very solid understanding of some of the social tensions that are at play in America right now. Probably they know far more about us than we know about them. I'll say that. And so understanding America as somebody high up within the government there might, they recognize that there are certain factors in this case and about the person involved that, you know, probably end up putting a damper on the empathy that a large portion of Americans are going to feel. And I line all that up to say, is there an understanding on their part that they can't really overplay their hand in this sort of situation? Does it seem highly likely to you that they will at some point want to make a trade?
Oh, that's a great question. So even if the Russian government is already winning in some sense by creating these domestic political divisions and things like that, they ultimately are holding Americans hostage because they want concessions in return. And so they're going to want to make a trade, but they're going to want to milk this for all it's worth. What we know about the offer that the United States government has put on the table, the State Department called it a substantial offer in line with past things that the Russians have demanded. CNN reported that that was an offer for Victor Boot, this arms dealer who's been sentenced for 25 years for supporting dictators and insurgencies all over the world. The Russians want him back, but if that was indeed the offer, it's pretty clear that Russia doesn't want to take yes for an answer. They're going to keep putting more demands on the table and try to increase pressure to get as much as they can out of this deal. And unfortunately, they're demonstrating that hostage taking is sometimes a really successful strategy in the short term.
And it can be successful, but I also recognize that the Biden administration wants to make sure that no matter what happens in this scenario, it doesn't send the message to other countries that this is a great way to get stuff out of America is by taking hostages. Is there a fine line that they walk? I guess I know that there's a fine line. I can answer my own question. I know there's a fine line that they walk. How do they determine how to walk it?
It's a great question. So throughout the history of hostage taking of Americans abroad, there has been an urge to commit ourselves to a no concessions policy. It's the fear that not only making concessions rewards our adversaries and pays our adversaries for this kind of egregious behavior, but that it also teaches our adversaries that this is a successful strategy. And by doing that, it puts a target on the back of Americans traveling all over the world. So the Biden administration really wants to avoid having that happen while at the same time using the tools it has at its disposal to bring our citizens home. And so with the executive order that the Biden administration announced a couple of weeks ago, that's the first effort to really shift the way that the U.S. will try to deter these attacks going forward. What the administration did in that executive order is announce a new type of sanctions that the United States can roll out on any individual who's responsible for or complicit in one of these wrongful detentions or a hostage taking of an American citizen. These will be both financial sanctions and visa bans. And not only will these sanctions target national leaders like Vladimir Putin, but it can apply to anyone who's been involved at any level of one of these egregious hostage takings. In other words, these might be sanctions against the rank and file in the Russian criminal justice system. And the hope is that by announcing those sanctions and implementing those sanctions in the coming weeks and months, that we're going to teach our adversaries not the lesson that hostage taking is successful for you, but instead that if you go after Americans, we're going to come for you and going to come for you in this very particular way.
Part of what I thought was really interesting about that new order was that the sanctions could be levied on a country based off of, say, what the family members of a prisoner are reporting back to the government based off of the treatment, which makes a lot of sense. It kind of makes you wonder why we didn't do this before. And it leads me to ask you about Otto Warmbier, who I mentioned earlier, who a couple years back was in North Korea, of all places, and he came back to us in a coma, then died a few days later. Is there any evidence to suggest that because America is a big, powerful country, they often have a lot that another country might want from them in the form of prisoners, financial help, anything like that, that they treat American detainees any better, just to make sure that the, essentially the goods aren't harmed as they do this long game negotiation. Or, I mean, in the case of North Korea, it doesn't seem to be the case, though they say that it was botulism that led to that coma. But I'll put it to you.
That's a really good question. And it's hard to know. There's not a lot of very good data about these cases because so much of what happens in secret and behind the scenes. A lot of my research is actually about kidnapping by non-state groups, by rebels in civil war. And what those kidnappers will say is that it's really important to protect your hostage in captivity. You have to give them somewhere to stay. You have to make sure that they're alive and healthy enough that you keep them alive for that trade. Because if they lose their life in captivity, then the hostage taker is not going to be able to get whatever concessions they're demanding. I know this is really morbid stuff to talk about and to be considering the position of the hostage takers here. But yes, they need to make sure that they keep their prisoners in good enough condition that they survive their captivity. And that might be one of the reasons that we see a lot of prisoner swaps in the moment that the prisoner or wrongful detainee has really declined in health. So Trevor Reed, who came home from Russia several months ago, there was evidence that his health was really struggling in the moment that he came home. Alan Gross, who was wrongfully detained in Cuba about a decade ago, also came home when his health was suffering. And so that might kind of speed along the negotiations, unfortunately, to make sure that the prisoner doesn't die in captivity.
One last thing, Danielle, because I know that so much of in America, so much of our worldview is very America-centric. But part of the criticism that America has received, especially in the case of Victor Boot, is that he was lured kind of into a trap by some officials who were posing as members of FARC and in another country. And so the criticism that they give is, well, America lures in, you know, foreign nationals by having them come to another country so they can nab them from there, then extradite them to the United States. Does America at all dabble in this idea of arresting people for the sake of maybe getting something from someone else somewhere as well?
Oh, what a tough question. So our adversaries around the world would say absolutely yes. They would say that the United States does this. They would criticize Guantanamo. They look at the American criminal justice system and accuse the United States of doing the very same thing. And this is one of the things that's so difficult about the international system of sovereign states. States have jurisdiction over the laws that they impose within their own countries. And it makes it really, really difficult to know when one of these arrests is for the purpose of using someone for leverage. I would say that the U.S. criminal justice system is not doing what Russia and China and Iran and Venezuela are doing in this case. I want to be clear about that. But they would all accuse the United States of doing the very same thing.
That's Danielle Gilbert. She's a postdoctoral fellow in foreign policy and international security at Dartmouth College. And her research focuses on international hostage diplomacy. Danielle, thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, why LA's new 6th Street Bridge connecting East LA to downtown can't seem to escape the headlines, and why the way that we talk about it matters. It's Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Austin Cross, back in 1 minute.
Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Air Talk. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle this week as he takes some much-needed time off. Right now, we are turning to the 6th Street Bridge. You've probably heard plenty about it by now. The so-called antics and outrageous driving, the illegal activity and takeovers. I drove it just 2 days ago to research for this conversation, and there was somebody pulled over, LAPD officer right there. But there's so much more to this story. The bridge has also been the site of photo shoots for quinceañeras, podcasting, marriage proposals, but those stories don't get shared as often, and that absence can be damaging and at the very least contribute to a disconnect between how the community is using the bridge versus widespread perceptions. Right? You're thinking about this now. Before we bring in our guests, I would like to ask our listeners to weigh in. Are you a resident of Boyle Heights? What does the bridge mean to you? How have you used it? You can give us a call, 866-893-5722. There is a line open for you, 866-893-5722. You can also email us, atcomments@kpcc.org. Just be sure to include your first name and where you're writing from. You can also tweet us at AirTalk or comment on the AirTalk Facebook page. Well, let's bring in Brian De Los Santos. He's host of the upcoming LAist Studios podcast, How to LA. Brian, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, Austin. Thanks for having me. Nice to hear from you.
It's always a good day when we have Brian De Los Santos on, and I'm going to ask you about your podcast in a few minutes, too, because this is some really exciting stuff. But just to start off, we have heard plenty of reporting on the safety issues around the bridge, the illegal activity, and so on. But there's a lot more to this story, obviously. Can you tell me a bit about your reporting, which I thought was just stellar? It's in LAist right now. I thought it was just stellar, and it was an approach that I had not seen anywhere else. But can you tell me about your reporting and specifically how you made it a point to approach the story of the bridge differently?
Yeah, Austin, I think the headlines and many news outlets and sometimes even including ours, we saw the official word on officials. Like we heard from LAPD, we heard from the city planners, and, you know, Caltrans and LA DOT are the folks who are behind the bridge, right? And so we see all the commotion happening, but I was like, but where are the folks who are actually want to use this in a different way? Yes, there are people doing donuts on the bridge. There are people kind of like taking over in the sense like they'll have a group of cars just like staying there and driving across. But what I really wanted to take a look at is like how are people feeling who live in the community, who live in Boyle Heights and other Eastside communities. So I talked to Eric Huerta, and he's a longtime Boyle Heights resident. I asked him what he really, really felt about the bridge. And at the beginning of our conversation, he's like, oh, man, he said, baby Jesus, I cannot begin to tell you the frustration he's having. So it just, to me, it felt like these are people that look like me. You know, I'm Latino. They're Latino. It is, you mentioned the quinceañeras. You mentioned the marriage proposal. It's people who are just excited about this. And one of the things that Eric said to me is like, look, this is a, kind of like a shiny new toy. It has this 15 minutes of fame. And yeah, you're going to get those TikToks that are kind of wilding out, right? You're going to see things on Facebook or Twitter of photos and people like having those awesome Instagram shots. It's something new for the community. And to be honest, when I walked it a couple of weeks ago, it was in the middle of the day. It was hot. So if any of y'all are going to go there in the middle of the day, you know, take some shade, take an umbrella. It's really hot out there. I walked it and I walked it a couple of times back and forth. And yeah, people were using bikes, skateboards, but really the activity happens at night, right? When people, the sun's going down, it's not as hot. People start walking their dogs. People start, you know, taking photos of the sunset. And what I noticed is like there was supposed to be a park underneath that bridge. That was supposed to be a part of a community center, right? There's no other space around there for people to just chill, to, you know, maybe meet up friends. And let's talk about the location of this bridge. It is right next to the Arts District if anyone has visited there recently, it's bustling with like restaurants, bars, other forms of entertainment, even offices, right? And on the other side, it's more of a residential community, maybe some industrial work. And in the middle, you see the railroad tracks and a bunch of warehouses. Mm. So really, the residents on the east side, they don't have a lot of spaces for them to just be people and just be outside. What I also, you know, I spoke to Eric. I asked him, like, how did officials, when they were planning this years ago, how did they connect with the community? And he told me, he's like, yes, they did their pop-up events. They asked for people to come in and weigh in. But it was like many times he said, it was when people were working. It was when it was too late at night, or it was just inconvenient for the times of those people who live in Boyle Heights. And so there might have been input from residents, but not many folks were able to attend those meetings.
Well, Brian, we also, you speak of Eric. Eric Huerta is actually on the line with us, too. So we're going to bring him into this conversation, too. He's a board member with the nonprofit group People for Mobility Justice and also hosts a podcast called Orale, Boyle Heights. Eric, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering, what kind of conversations are you having with people in the community? And what do you think that the main narrative that's kind of been circulating about, you know, all these misdeeds happening on the bridge, what do you think that it's getting wrong or leaving out?
Yeah, I've been having all sorts of conversations, and they've been all very interesting, very fun, and have pushed my own boundaries and understanding of how community, you know, can interact with such a space like that. And, you know, for every person that I talk to, I always get a different opinion, but I do see a pattern. I do see a trend. And that biggest one is this issue of respectability politics. Mm. This issue of when the bridge opened up and people started, you know, acting foolish and doing all these things, the first thing that started coming out of people's mouth in English and in Spanish was the quote unquote, this is why we can't have nice things. This is why people see us the way they see our community as it is, right? And I really try to understand where that feeling come from of, you know, that we have something that is new. It's for the community. It's for the whole city. It's for everybody to enjoy. But why do we feel we have to take this ownership, right, of infrastructure like that when it's for everybody to enjoy? It's for everybody to use it. It's for everybody to do their own thing on it.
You know, Eric, something that's so interesting about respectability politics, and it's pretty much the second I started reading these headlines about why can't we have nice things, I thought, oh, that's it. That's it. I mean, just call it out what it is. I'm glad that you did. But I also know that what comes with respectability politics within a community of color especially isn't just, you know, why are we doing this to, you know, something in our own backyard, but it's also we don't want other people to see certain people from this community doing things in our backyard and painting our whole community with a broad brush. Do you get the sense that that's a feeling at all in this scenario?
Exactamundo. You hit the nail on the head. And I can point to our council member, Kevin De Leon, as a perfect example. He can ride his bike and cruise in a lowrider on the bridge all he wants. But as soon as community members start doing it, it's a problem. It's a problem that needs cameras. It's a problem that needs more police enforcement. It's a problem that needs to be dealt with. So there's definitely a lot of double standards here in how the community is interacting with the bridge and how other people, especially like elected officials, just come in for a photo op. They take the credit for it. They're like, I helped fund this bridge. I worked on it. I planned it all these years. And that's part of the big disconnect as well.
Talking right now with Eric Huerta, board member with People for Mobility Justice and host of the podcast Orale Boyle Heights. I'm also talking with Brian De Los Santos, host of the LAist Studios podcast, How to LA. One more question for you, Eric, before I slide back to Brian for a second. But Brian did mention that you had told him about kind of a lack of outreach, a lack of an actual open conversation about this bridge and the role that it would play in the community. And I don't think that that's gotten enough attention. What works in these scenarios? Because I've lived in communities like these. I mean, I live in South Central right now, so that's just about 10 minutes away from the bridge. I've lived in these communities long enough to know that one event usually isn't enough to raise awareness and let people know what's happening, because people got to work, people have lives, you know, people maybe don't speak English, maybe it's not engaging them in the right way. What could have been done better in this conversation that needed to happen as the bridge was being conceived and built?
For sure. I mean, moving forward, you know, I think it's also, you know, a breath for us to say that and acknowledge all the work that went into it, right? Despite it still having shortfalls, I think we're missing a part of it, that for all the work that the engineers did, for all the architecture students that worked on it, for everybody that had a hand in it, you know, it's not to say that we're criticizing the work and not appreciative, because we are, right? They built this bridge and it took so many years and so much money, but that's also where the shortfalls comes. Anytime the planning department, the department of DOT, anybody from the city comes into a community and hosts a community gathering, it's like you said, it's never at an opportune time. It's never at a time where the community members who would be most impacted by this change, by this infrastructure, are able to meet there, are able to attend, to express their opinion. And sometimes there's language barriers, right? There's not enough opportunities to translate the materials into another language. It's also, the language is very technical, so sometimes the ideas go over our head. I know I've had that happen to me many a time at these planning meetings. And sometimes it just comes down to, you know, these planners just doing outreach to check a box, and all they have people do is place stickers on poster boards or on boards. And they say, if you like this, put a green sticker on it. If you don't like this, put a red sticker on it. And that's the extent of the process.
So, dear listener, we have so far established two things. You have a situation where some of the misdeeds happening in one place get amplified, and therefore it affects the public perception. Then on the other hand, we have people who maybe feel that they could have been reached out to more. And at the heart of it, who really gets affected are the people in that community, because they're going to get painted with that broad brush, because they're going to be told they're not behaving properly, even though maybe there could have been some things done in the process that could have made them act differently in this scenario, which is why I think it is so important to highlight the narrative. What is the narrative around a story? And for that, I'm going to go back to Brian De Los Santos. And this is a great way in to your podcast, How to LA, Brian, because I can tell from the approach that you took to this that, you know, you've seen that maybe something is missing from the way that certain stories get told and whose voice gets amplified. So tell me a little bit about How to LA, which it's not out yet, but it is coming out. Maybe you can tell us more about that too. But this is, you know, from our station, from our studios, and it continues on what we do here, but it approaches it in a different way, in the Brian De Los Santos flavored way. So tell us a little bit about that, Brian.
You're the best. I love that intro, Austin. Thank you. Yeah, we're launching this podcast late August, and really at the center of this multi-platform project, because we're going to have a newsletter. We're also going to use social media. I mean, if y'all know Austin Cross, he's a TikTok star by now. You guys can TikTok. But we really want to center LA as a community. We need to connect with our audiences, but really it's the people of LA. You know, it's people who sound and look like me and my friends, like you and your friends. It's people who may be new to the city, or maybe they're longtime residents and were born here and they know the ins and outs. I don't know everything. My team doesn't know everything, but we're definitely going to be leaning on audiences, on people who listen, on people who read the newsletter, to tell us about their experiences, to tell us what makes the city like click. We're going to offer things to, like, how to explore Los Angeles, or how do you connect with the community you want to connect to? Like, whether it's like you're a working mom and you want to meet other working moms. We're going to also give resources. So if you want to affect change, even just like trying to plant a tree, or how to do that, you know, how do you connect with city services? Be like, hey, I need more green space here in Los Angeles in my block. How do you connect for change? And of course, you know, we want to tell you what it is. And I think this story kind of is in part of that idea, that mantra I have for this project, this podcast, is we want to take a look at stories that are being told in a different way. It is, you know, part of it is the officials of the shutdown. It is the budget. It is additional money to create more space like the bridge. But it's also about the people. And that's what really influenced me. And you know, Eric was just awesome to talk to. And he guided me through, like, his thought process and what a lot of people have been thinking. And I think Eric is not the only one. I saw a lot of people on social media being like, you know, listening to the people, the city had to change certain ways. And, yo, like, L.A. is a car-centric city.
Oh, yeah.
If we have more green spaces, I don't know, maybe more happier and less road rage.
I think we can all get behind more green space, and I'll point out for people, because people don't always see the behind the scenes, but I'm so glad we get to amplify voices like Eric Huertas, and Eric was connected to us by way of Brian De Los Santos. So I love to see it. And I want to thank you both for coming on. Brian De Los Santos, host of the upcoming LAist Studio podcast, How to LA, and Eric Huerta. He's on the board of the nonprofit People for Mobility Justice. He also hosts the podcast Orale Boyle Heights. Thank you both so much for coming on. And coming up, we will get a better understanding of the toll dyslexia is taking on students here in California. KPCC and LAist, oh, you know, we're staying busy here. That's what we do. We have How to LA coming out, and KPCC and LAist have a new project that focuses on the nation's most common learning disorder, and that's often misunderstood disorder. We'll discuss it after the break. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle on Air Talk.
Support for LAist comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Mix Mix, the Filipino Adventures of a German Jewish Boy by Boney B. Alvarez. Inspired by true events from the life of Ralph Price, after escaping Nazi Germany, a newfound tropical refuge in the Philippines is upended when Japan invades the islands. On stage through June 16th. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
To say, I always love the jams on Air Talk. Evelyn Bocanegra on the board, making us sound so dang good. It's Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle this week. Coming up at 11, listen for 1A. On today's show, somebody out here is going to be really into this. On today's show, you know, back in May, Congress held its first hearing on UFOs in 50 years, right? I know somebody's like, ooh. Now the Pentagon has created a new office to track what they call UAPs, or Unidentified Aerial Phenomena. I've never heard that one before. But what is behind America's obsession with UFOs, and what role can and should the government play in tracking them? That's 1A coming up at 11 here on KPCC. So about 18 minutes from now, it's Out of This World. I had to pull in the dad jokes. You know, that's what I got to do. Well, right now, we are pulling the tarp off a brand new project that the education team here at KPCC and LAist have been working hard at for the past few months. The focus is dyslexia, our nation's most common learning disorder. It affects somewhere between 5 and 20% of the population. Why such a wide range, you might ask? Well, dyslexia exists on a spectrum, and people can experience it in ways from mild to severe. With us today to preview this new series that you will hear on 89.3 KPCC and read on our oh-so-great website, LAist.com, is Ross Brenneman, KPCC and LAist education editor, who has been leading the production of this series. Ross, it's so great to have you on Air Talk.
Thank you for having me, Austin.
So just to kick us off, tell me about this project and what made you and your team decide that dyslexia was the thing to focus on.
Sure. So we really wanted to do a story, a package that showed that education exists on a continuum. We often think of it in different buckets, like here's early childhood, here's K-12, here's higher education. But that's not really how students experience it. They experience it as an education. And a really great example of that is students with special needs, and the fact that we there's a lot of research that shows, you know, when you help students early and make sure they're set with the skills they need early, that it pays dividends throughout the rest of their education. And dyslexia is a great example of that as the most common learning disability in the United States.
Now, I'm wondering if we can break apart this word dyslexia, because I think that oftentimes, you know, certain words like that, they kind of enter into our lexicon and people use it improperly. They'll make, you know, they'll maybe make a mistake in reading something and then quip that they have dyslexia. But there's so much to it. And some people who have lived for so long undiagnosed, talk to me about some of the different ways dyslexia can manifest itself.
Sure. So the most common is trouble reading. But it can also be trouble spelling. It can be memory issues. There's a whole host. But what people would tell you is that definitely number one is trouble with reading.
So talk about some of the neuroscience that you and your team learned through this process.
Yeah. So one of the things that I really loved about this project was that we did a lot of group interviews. You know, usually reporters are out on their own, and this is a great opportunity for us all to come together. We were talking to neuroscientists and to other experts and folks. And one of the people we talked to was Rebecca Gottlieb at UCLA, and she was taking us through how the brain lights up when people are reading and speaking, and basically that the pattern of activity in the brains of people with dyslexia looks different than in the brains of people without dyslexia. But what's really cool also is that with proper intervention early, that brain activity changes, the brain actually changes. And so those with dyslexia, their brains will start to look more like those, will activate more similarly to those without dyslexia.
And that early intervention piece is so important because some have said that dyslexia can be a contributor to the school-to-prison pipeline. So this is a very real thing that could have some very real effects on a person's life. And it leads us to this, the schools. Does California require screening for dyslexia in young children for that early noticing that you're talking about?
No. California is one of 10 states that does not screen universally for dyslexia. There are dyslexia guidelines that the state put out in 2017 that was in response to a mandate from the legislature. There was originally going to be a universal screening bill in 2015. You can actually look at the amended part of that bill where they strip out all the mandates and say, we're going to develop some guidelines. And it is a very thorough document. It's 136 pages, but it's not mandatory. Other states have there's a whole list of different kinds of best practices that advocacy groups recommend. California doesn't have many of them. So it's definitely been a hot political issue here.
Based on your reporting, and I only have a couple minutes left here, but I really want to get this out because what we do here is we are storytellers. So you have the research, you have the knowledge. But is there a story that stood out to you from your research that kind of helps paint a picture for people of just how important it is to, you know, discover this early and maybe what happens if you don't?
Sure. So we asked the community for their experiences, and more than 200 people wrote in, which I think is phenomenal. A lot of frustration, a lot of pain, some reasons for optimism as well, for sure. But one of the stories that I liked the most was a mom who wrote in to say that her son had been struggling in school really early and just felt like he couldn't succeed and that it was really hurting his self-esteem. And so when they went out and they got a diagnosis of dyslexia, she said it was like a wave of relief because they finally had a name for it. So many people think that people with dyslexia with reading problems are lazy or unmotivated when that's definitely not the case. It is a real struggle to read, and it can often be really, really confusing, especially at a young age.
Well, Ross, this is an important part of your reporting, is hearing from people. If someone listening right now has an experience that they'd like to share, how can they connect with you and your team?
So they can go to laist.com. That's laist.com. And they can find our story where we've embedded it's called Typeform. It's just a short form where they can submit their experience. We are still looking for those kinds of stories from all over. We have another 5 weeks of this project, and those submissions are still informing our work.
That's Ross Brenneman. He's the education editor here at KPCC. Ross, thank you so much for coming to talk about this reporting. I am really looking forward to reading and hearing the stories that you're rolling out for this.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we spotlight another one of our incredible local heroes. You're going to want to stick around for this. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle on Air Talk. Welcome back to Air Talk. It is so good to be with you on this Thursday. I'm Austin Cross. I'll be with you tomorrow as well. Come hang out. We always try to keep the Friday vibes alive here. We've been saying it for a while now, and it's still true. The news is a lot to handle right now. I feel like that's just a blanket statement. You could have heard this in 2016, and you would have said, yeah, man, yeah, for sure. But that's why Air Talk has carved out some time every week to highlight a local hero who's making a positive difference in the community. And this week, our local hero is Chuck Levin, who has personally registered over 14,000 people to vote in California since he began volunteering as a voter register in 1968. Chuck, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for the invitation, and really mostly thanks for the recognition. It's an honor. I appreciate that.
You know, we love people who do their part for democracy, because you got to keep democracy alive or else. So 14,000, it's a lot of people, a lot of people to convince to register to vote. This is, first off, as a matter of process, how do you go about finding the people and registering them?
Yeah, it's one by one at a table or standing with a group of people who might be online at a movie theater. Since 1968, mostly setting up a table in front of a local merchant that I've come to know or who appreciates what I'm trying to do. The first place I registered to vote myself was in Westwood Village at Stan's Donut Shop, iconic legendary Stan's. There was a deputy registrar of voters. That was the only way you could register to vote. Back in the day, 1968, someone had to register you to vote, someone who was authorized, someone who was deputized by the county registrar of voters. And I'm sure I registered as soon as I could at age 21. And I was so impressed with that person helping to enfranchise me, allowing me to then become part of our democracy, that I decided I wanted to do the same thing. So all I had to do is go down to, at that time it was in Chinatown, the Registrar of Voters offices in Chinatown, take a little 4-hour class seminar, understand the process, be given affidavits, and I could go out anywhere, set up a table. I went to, my college, Cal State Long Beach. I went around Westwood Village. As I said, Stan's Donuts was a regular place. And, of course, people would pass by. I had some signs. And takes about really only 3 minutes to register to vote. Sometimes persuasion was necessary. Sometimes on the opposite end, people ran up to want to sit down.
Well, let me ask you this really quickly, because you said you started in 1968, and I know that, you know, if there's any political historian people listening, 1968 was a rather important year. Of course, there's the Democratic Convention in Chicago that pretty much turned into a riot. And I'm wondering if that at all worked as a motivator for you back when you were 21 and you decided to register to vote.
Well, 68, as you said, was a very important year in the decade of revolution, really. Positive things happened. Negative things happened. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. quote Charles Dickens, but it's true. But I actually, myself personally, became very interested in current events and news and issues even before high school, but primarily in high school. University High School is a special school not far from Westwood Village. And Austin, I learned about the war. I learned about farm workers, and I learned about Martin Luther King. Those three issues are the issues that motivated me personally.
Those are very big issues, especially back then. There was a documentary called Harvest of Shame that highlighted the struggles of farm workers. And I think that it came out on Thanksgiving Day, so it showed Americans something, a side of their food production that they'd never seen. Let me ask you this, because I only get a couple minutes left with you, but are there any people or moments from your time registering voters that's really stuck out to you, maybe a brief story of somebody who you've helped register?
Well, you know, I haven't done this by myself, and I'm lucky that along the way, we live in the entertainment capital of the world, and along the way, there are a couple of people I want to mention who came out to help me in a big way. Sarah Jessica Parker, met her in 1986 to 1990. Most every Friday night, she came out to help me at Cantor's Delicatessen. And also Alexandra Paul, actress, activist, has never stopped helping me since 1986. That's many years of coming out very regularly, registering people to vote. So that's kind of cool. But I do remember in Westwood Village, there was a senior citizen housing, maybe 15-story building. And I was invited, my mother, who also registered voters, we were invited to come twice a year. And I actually registered a woman, Lillian, who was 101 years old. And you have to think to yourself, wow, Lillian, you know, moved from her house, but she had to be registered to vote so she could register for the next election. That's what she cared about. And then there's the 18-year-olds that it's, you know, a thrill for me when an 18-year-old steps up to the table and, you know, their parents aren't pushing them. No one's pushing them. They know that this is the fundamental element of the democracy. As you said at the beginning, we have a democracy, and, voting is an essential part of it. And in order to do that, you have to register to vote. It only takes 3 minutes.
I'm talking with Chuck Levin. He's our local hero. Now, Chuck, we only have about 30 seconds left, but I'm going to kind of role play with you. If I'm walking into a donut shop or Cantor's and you're sitting out there with your table, what's your pitch to get me active?
Well, I don't know how fast you're going to be walking, but let me say this. I have three signs, and you can read the three signs, or you're going to hear me say these things. For decades, I say that your vote is the one that counts. I say, please register to vote and vote in every election. And I say, one of my signs says, vote. When we participate, we strengthen democracy. So that's my message. Sometimes it takes persuasion. Sometimes it's just the fact that I'm there. People can do it online. People can fill out a form themselves. But sometimes it's helpful if you can do something, you know, face-to-face.
Well, Chuck Levin, you are our local hero of the week and from all of us here at KPCC. And I'm sure I'm speaking for many of the people listening at home, too. Thank you so much for making a difference in our community. I know it's just this week we're highlighting you, but 14,000 is no small feat. And I also want to give some attention to your mother as well, because she registered even more people than that. And I just really want to thank you for your work, because democracy does need to be maintained.
All the best. Thank you for the attention.
That's Chuck Levin. Personally registered over 14,000 people to vote in California since he began volunteering as a voter register in 1968. And to all of our listeners, thank you so much for doing your part to keep democracy alive and for being with us today. I'm Austin Cross. I'll be with you again tomorrow, starting at 10 for one final go-round. Well, Larry wraps up his vacation. 1A is coming up next here, and it's a good one. We're talking UFOs. Stay cool, Earthlings.
B
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at las.com/sweeps.